Okay, so let's just recapitulate this thing. Okay, now, Jettinger's hung up at about 15,000. That's where he was left by his own, by the Outward Bound crew. He had been at 16,000 when his own crew left. Okay, so you go in there, you found out that his own crew got down to 14,300. They radioed you, told you about him. And they wanted some snowshoes in there so they could pack down a runway.
There's snowshoes that lost in the avalanche.
Okay, so you took some snowshoes, some fruit and stuff in there, dropped them. And then you went back. In fact, they couldn't stamp out a runway because there's 7 feet of soft snow.
That's what they thought.
Right. So they took off down the mountain, heading for 10,000 feet. Okay. Now, you then, at that point, knew that this guy was up there, and the Outward Bound crew was coming out. They spot him at 16,000, bring him down to 15,000, and then they couldn't hack it because the weather was building up again. So they come on out. Okay, so now, here's Jettinger at 15,000 feet, tied to the side of the mountain. There's a heck of a storm blowing. His parents want him to come out. This is, you know, they've been on you all this while to get him out of there. And you tell them, I can't get him where he's at, but if we could get him down to 14,300, I can get him out.
Well, I told him if I could get Janae to help me.
Right, okay. So you talked with Janae about it and his comings and goings, and he agreed to go up with you and give her a whirl. Okay, so you take him up there in the morning, and...
We got there in the afternoon. Remember, the snow was about 5 or 6 feet deep and sticky.
Okay, but if
it
took
the
8 hours
in the afternoon.
Okay, so you went up there and landed with Sinead.
See, and you just have only small intervals to dwell when you can land up there.
Yeah, right. I understand.
The clouds and the wind. When it did clear, the hot sun came out. The wind went down.
Yeah.
I landed in a perfect calm, no wind condition, except in this big blanket of 5 or 6 feet
of snow.
Snow that was powdery,
yeah.
But a hot west sun beat on it and made it sticky, believe it or not. And it was like landing on taffy.
Okay, so you and Janae get there, and you got to put your snowshoes on, and you said 8 hours to stamp out a runway. Okay, now.
Non-stop 8 hours.
Okay. So this would have made it at least, if you got there in the afternoon, it made it at least 8, 9 o'clock at night when you got out of there.
Well, let's see.
That's why I said in the morning.
We'll check with her and see. Maybe it was a little earlier in the day.
Okay, so anyway.
Anyway, the heat of the day, whatever it was, well, give or take 2 or 3 hours.
You spent the rest of the
day. It was more like noon than early in the morning.
You spent the full afternoon standing your runway down anyway. Okay, so then she starts to blow again.
Yeah.
And you tell Janae, man, I got to get going before I get hung in here with
some
real bad weather.
Well, I was obviously going to blow the plane off the south face of McKinley.
Right. So,
because off from the bowl to the south is the south face, the Kassim route.
Yeah, right.
And it goes down for thousands of feet.
Yeah, right.
See?
So you get in the airplane, crank her up. Janae gives you a shove, and you take off into a 50 knot headwind.
The wind's
50 mile an hour.
Came roaring and ripping and screaming from the west. Ideal.
So you take out, you go back to tell Keaton. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is late evening.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you get back to tell Keaton, you're tired, you hit the sack, you tell Roberta that if Janae calls, which you probably won't, tell him I'll be in there at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Roberta's just about ready to hit the sack. The radio comes live. Here's Janae up there. He says, okay, I'm back at 14,300 and I got him. Mm-hmm. Got him up here at 14,300.
Yeah.
Janae spends the night up there in a hole in the snow and with his mountain gear. And then the next morning at 6 o'clock, he's on again, right? On the radio?
Yeah.
Okay. And he says, hey, the weather's okay up here.
Wait. At this point, here would be a good place for a graphic illustration of the West Buttress a la Washburn. Go ahead.
Okay.
Where he was at
and
where he fell.
Yeah. Okay. So he tells you the weather's okay up there. But, you know, you look at it and you can't see how it can be okay. Unless you
the clouds look like a mixed mask.
Okay, right. So, but you decide, well, I'll give it a try anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So you go up there and you're in Mull Elliott clouds. You can't, you flounder around up in there trying to get to 14.3. You can't make it. So you turn around and almost get lost finding your way back out. And you go back to Cal Keaton. And he's on the radio again. And he says, it's good weather up here. Come on in and get me. And this is how long, right after you got back, back on the radio.
Well, I spent an hour and a half getting back to Cal Keaton.
Yeah.
Well, a total hour. Well, let's see. Now, wait a minute. I must have spent on the lapse time of almost 2 hours from the time I left town. When I got back, I no sooner got down than they called again.
Yeah.
Says, boy, it's really good now.
Yeah.
Calm, no snow, bright sun.
Yeah. Okay, why don't you go ahead, because this is where we ended on another tape.
Okay, so then I gassed the plane up and took off for the 14.3 level. This time I made it. And in the meanwhile, there's another foot or two of new snow, which today had flattened down in good shape. And also he had Jattinger at 14.3. So we loaded the lad up inside the airplane. And I made a fireball run to Cal Keaton. My objective was to turn right around and make several more trips and wipe out that level. Anyway, I no sooner got within a mile or two of the 14.3 level than in came another line squall and obscured the mountain. Turbulence, wind, snow, sleet, and unbelievable winds. So in disgust, here I am. 2 miles more I want to land, and I hit this turbulence. Again, this mixture of various types of air having a big collision right up over the top of McKinley. So I said, so I know what I'll do. I'll zap into Cal Keaton and take jatting Anchorage, which I did. And then sooner got back to Anchorage. Janae calls, says, come on in, the weather's fine. I say, what's the wind? The wind went down with the storm. Says it snowed another foot. Says stomp her down. He did. So I went up there this afternoon by now.
Jake.
And
really please don't be that.
And I looked at about 3 loads of gear there. And I said, I think I'll take a load of freight down to the 7,000 foot level, because lo and behold, in the west, rapidly approaching is another line squall, moving fast. Anyway, we no sooner loaded this load up and took it to the 7,000 foot level and returned to 14 level, and I had trouble landing in about a 30 mile an hour tailwind. And we looked at the freight, we have 2 loads. And I said, Janae, we can only make 1 flight out of here. What are we going to do? You want to leave the gear? He says, well, tie part of it on the outside, stuff the rest inside, and with this wind you should be able to get off, because he did have a good runway feed down by then. Then I said, fine, we'll try. So we accomplished the wing tie on to the pack sacks and the stuff, the plane full of gear and hardware and crampons and Jumars and pitons and spare sleeping bags and everything, and the storm struck head on, 40, 50 miles an hour, which is just what we needed, because we barely made it off before we got to the big ice hole you could drop a hotel in, 2,200 feet down the slope.
So then that was her. You took her back.
And then,
back.
The area to the southeast, we returned to Talkeetna and blocked. But we can't get to Talkeetna. There's a solid overcast of 5,000 feet solid. And it's moving and rapidly moving. And so, and to the north don't look too good. They're overcast to maybe 8,000 foot level. So, when these incoming storms hit, sometimes you can, depends on the direction, if they're from the southwest, for instance, you can use the Yetna Glacier as an escape route. If the wind drafts and create a funnel, and you can fly down the funnel and get under these layers. So that's the way we got out of there.
Mm-hmm. So where did that put you when you get out of the
air? Cathedral Spires. You turn just before you get to the Cathedral Spires down the Yetna.
So you turn just before you get to the Spires.
Yeah. They're 10,000-11,000 feet.
Okay, so when you come out down below, where did that get
sweating.
Where are you looking? Sweating.
Yeah, well, we got under the overcast by going down the funnel.
Yeah, right.
And getting desperately low on gas. The fact that
they say you flew
around
this part of
the
country.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway,
good.
Anyway, see these weather systems, they move fast. And thermals travel at alarming rates of speed. And see, the problem is that in a given limited amount of time, you can't get everything done you like to do. You're overtaken, and you have to resolve that you'll either spend the night on the mountain, land, turn around, run for your life, or whatever, without being trapped. I made almost a blind landing. On one occasion, and made it on a glacier I never saw before. Coming out from a late fall, late in the afternoon, in a big storm system, out of the whole thing, 7,000 foot level. There's a dozen good places to land on the Kehelma Glacier, but I got up over the layers to the west, and see, these peaks are ragged and tall, and the main thing is to miss most of the big peaks.
Okay, well, that pretty well gets your kind of down.
That's a good story. It's got the Regine in it, a lot of flying in it. It's got a tragedy on the mountains type of thing. It's a good one. That's a good one.
Hey, I tell you, but when I don't think we got down, I was making this 5,000 pound airdrop to the the outdoor leadership program.
Well, we got that one on tape.
Yeah, but when the ranger station contacted me, I was relaying the gear from Kentish airstrip to the base of the source of the Mulder Glacier, the base of the Harper's Glacier, Harper's Ice Fall, and one of the rangers met me where I loaded the freight and said, "Say," said, "it's a little citizen, man. We contacted a climbing outfit that was flying their own expedition airlift, airdrop, and they crashed. And the planes demolished, and fella flying the plane making airdrops solo, and he's badly injured. And you find him. And he's in the Trelaika area. And as I say, I was all loaded up with this big load of gear.
Mm-hmm.
I had about 900 pounds of gear in the Cessna with an airdrop. To Harper's Ice Ball, and I said, fine, I'll drop this and go look for it. So I roared up there, dropped the 900 pounds, and went over in the Trelaika area and looked for the lost airplane, for the wreckage. And I spotted a pile of the most twisted junk you can imagine.
And what kind of plane was your plane?
It was a 120 Cessna on wheels. And what had happened, he's dropping large boxes of soil out of the Cessna. And he's dropping out the right door, flying from the left, and he leaned on the wheel and drove the whole thing into the ground and turned upside down and destructed it.
Yeah.
And rolled him and the engine right up under the tail.
Hmm.
Looked like a bent tin can. And it was scattered around. So I climbed up to 12,000, 13,000 feet. And gave the Nana a call. And I told him I had wreckage in sight, and I called Roberto on the HF radio and told her I had the wreckage in sight, and then I had Roberto call the rescue, and they sent up sent out a message to one of their Huey helicopters, which was en route Anchorage Fairbanks, and intercepted him about halfway, and he came right over.
This was search and rescue?
No, it was an Army Huey.
Hmm.
It just happened to be en route to Fairbanks, and we intercepted him halfway, which was just right.
Hmm.
And
you say you called Nenana before you called Roberta?
Yeah.
And why did you call Nenana?
Well, I want to get somebody, and then somebody that had wreckage.
I see. You figured you had a better chance there to get through.
Well,
I wasn't to
that VHF.
Right.
Is real good.
Yeah.
Those TSO'd airline kings, and so I just used that for ace and all. I tell them what I was going to do, and they said, fine. Call Roberta. Fine. Call the rescue. Fine. The Huey's already on the way.
Halfway right there.
Going to go to Fairbanks on another mission. Diverted him.
Got him in.
He went over, circled around, and he sat down, picked the guy up. The guy's name was Weisenkopf. Weisenkopf. And he dropped me a card later from the hospital.
You know what Weisenkopf means in German?
What?
Smart head. He wasn't very smart, was he?
No. Anyway, the point is that if you get these, there's a good reason for having good equipment.
Oh,
you can reach out and grab them with the head.
Yeah. How many airplanes, Don, would you say over, let's say, the last 15 years, stacked up there on McKinley?
Well, there was Elliot Stevenson deal in 60.
Yeah, right, Dave Beatty.
And Weisenkopf, and slightly F4, and not a great number in the middle 40s. There was the Northwest.
Yeah, right. I remember that.
Got hung on the Mount Silverstone.
But I meant small airplanes going in there and trying to fly resupply to these groups and one thing and another.
No, that's
not too many. Of course, the regulations keep them out, pretty much now, I suppose.
Well, the thing is, there's nothing. They may fly a reconnaissance flight. They don't.
Can't do anything with the Yeah. Okay, Don. We got her. Jadinger. Jadinger is going to be. She's gone.
Now, on the Von Wetzel helmet, the Raphael Mount Russell climb, you recall that what I want to make sure we have here is a punchline. See? Because this will be effective, I hope. And that is when I took out the main members. The Helmut Raphael German expedition. Mm-hmm. There was one missing member.
I got because, it on.
Now wait a minute.
I know what you're going to say.
Now wait a minute.
You need some sleep alone.
Yeah, but wait a minute.
Okay.
What I wanted to make sure of was he had a little preliminary explanation there, and that was here you have this. 6'6" Prussian general type German doctor, no question about it. He's got a wax mustache with a 6-inch wingspan.
Yeah.
He's wears a monocle on his right eye, and he's weather-beaten, and he's saber-scarred. He's got a saber scar on his left cheek that took the top of his ear off. He's battle damaged, and just outstanding. Statue of a man, a fine specimen of the old Prussian military type. And he stands straight and erect. And he's pushing 70 years old.
70?
Well, yeah, he's.
Jeez. And he's going to climb, he's going to climb the mountain?
Well, he's the doctor.
How much climbing did he end up actually doing?
Well, don't worry about Von Wetzel.
But I'm just curious. How much? Well, did he actually go up with them?
Six of them, put the three of them on top of Mount Russell.
But he was more as a backup type.
But what I want to say is that you couldn't underestimate a guy like Von Wetzel.
Right.
See? And he's brusque. And they're not known for their tact in Germany.
I'm a German.
Yeah. I want to explain right here that due to the press of traffic, it's almost more than the guy can handle in the daylight. So you fly all night. And it was on a day like this, when I'd flown two or three days and one night before, and I'm running it into the following third day, that I meet Von Wetzel as he steps off the train. He's got two big satchels. Medical satchels full of all kinds of medical stuff, and then his baggage is extra. And I know it's Von Wetzel, no question about that. And he steps off the train, and I rush over there, and I'm wearing my old shirt, sweat stained and dried three or four times. I'm red eyed from lack of sleep, and disheveled, and all mussed up. And I am not too presentable to the general type, Prussian Von Wetzel. And trying to be friendly, I say, sir, you must be Von Wetzel, the doctor for Helmut Raphael expedition. And at this point, here's what he said. He diagnosed my case and come up with a prescription right here. And this is when he said, young man, what you need is sleep alone.
All right.
Now, I want you to get the explanation.
Already got it, Don.
Yeah.
Here, you want to read it?
Yeah.
I got it right here. I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to let you read this little part of it.
Well, you're going to read it anyway.
I know it, but you jump into the middle of the thing. It's kind of bad. I tell you, this thing is so loaded. Look at this. Let me read it to you. Because there's so many. This is going to be a thing, too, and you might have a tough time reading some of this, because
It's been corrected out, and this is the only totally corrected copy I've got. I didn't want to go through both of these. I got a carbon of this, but man, to correct both of them. Okay, now, one thing I want you to know here, because so that I could, I don't know exactly what your activities are while you're waiting there until Keaton for Von Wetzel to get there.
Christ, we're hauling the...
Okay, I know that, but I mean 20 minutes before he gets there. I don't know what you're doing, you know.
I'm waiting for him.
Okay,
I don't want to
miss
him.
I got you waiting in your Jeep at the railroad station. You may have been over in your office sitting there waiting.
No,
I don't know
no. I just come in from a flight. I didn't want to miss him. I'm here a few minutes early to meet the train.
Okay. So I got you there a few minutes early, but you're in your Jeep waiting for him. Because in the other tape, you said you were there with your Jeep.
Okay.
In 1962, now I go through a description of the Jeep here. There's no sense other than that. Yeah, let's get down here to where we start doing what you just told me here. Now, let me see what you think of it. Sheldon arrived early. Now, this I've already described the railroad station in Talkeetna. And the place was almost devoid of the regulars who daily wandered over to meet the train. That's in quotes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
One of his truly rare chances to idle away a brief few minutes. And behind closed eyes, he silently totaled up the climbers that were now on the mountain under his care. Now, what you know, you're sitting there just waiting 10 minutes for him. I did this, Don, just simply to get a chance to sum up who was up on the mountain at that particular moment. Okay. This is a quote. The previous 2 days had been another hassle, and I had just finished an uninterrupted 36-hour stretch flying climbers to McKinley and elsewhere. I had climbers on the mountain and had wanted to put the burn on her while good weather held. I had described what the weather had been like when the rest of the Rethel group had got there. Okay. Now, this is not quotes. One of the first parties that Sheldon moved out was led by a, quote, mountain climber extraordinaire. That's a quote from you. He was a German named Helmut Rethel, who, with a crew of 8 hand-picked German and American experts, would have...
He only had one American.
Two of them.
No.
That's what Washburn said.
Listen, the
what were the
got
names?
The name wrong.
What was their names?
I'll think of the name of the guy.
I got their names.
No, the park's got the wrong name.
I didn't get it from the park.
Well,
I got it from Washburn's tapes.
Well, I don't
he
know what he told you, but I'll tell you the name
approved.
Of the one American in that team. And he's an engineer, and he's got a, he used to be down in Alaska. I think of his name here soon.
And I'll give it to you
in a minute.
Let me find it here, and I'll give it to you. You see?
Okay. But look, there was only one American in that team. And this, oh boy, I almost forgot his name. I'll think of it, go ahead.
Got it right in here. See, this is why it's tough getting right into the middle of something trying to read it. This is what I was talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if when you read this,
mm-hmm.
you could put that guy's name down and swear to the fact that he's not a German, and there's only one American on the crew,
right.
And if you can give me the rest of the crew's names, we'll put her in here.
I was appalled.
Otherwise, I got to go with what Washburn said.
Hey, yeah.
Because, you know, he's got every name, he reads them right off.
Well,
these were the men on the party, and he said two of them were Americans. And he read the names right off to me, see? So I got to go with that.
Goodwin.
Goodwin?
Yeah, look for Goodwin.
Right, well,
Goodwin's not there.
Let's read this. Now
one American.
I'll come
Goodwin.
To the name. Okay.
Goodwin from Alaska.
All right.
Engineer.
So when you get to that, you can say in one American.
Yes, sir.
Crew of 8 hand-picked German experts, including one American. Okay, would attempt the yet unconquered Mount Rushmore.
Goodwin down.
I've got it down. It's in here.
Oh, you did, huh?
Yeah.
Good.
To the west of Mount Forker, the McKinley group. Rethel was one of the, quote, old school, old world climbers, unquote, who, among others of their breed, have amassed brilliant careers in mountaineering the world over. He was a stern, hawk-eyed veteran. Now, I didn't know whether he was.
A one-eyed veteran, too. He was.
Okay. Well, you can add this in when you...
Well,
you didn't
I'm
give me a description of Rethel. So
yeah,
I'm
well,
just
that's good.
Here.
That's good.
So if you
Hawkeye could
yeah.
mean one.
Okay,
eye.
So if you know you want to add something to
go
it,
ahead.
Put it in the tape.
He was a stern, hawk-eyed veteran, and his crew bore the unmistakable aura of having already measured up to his high expectations.
That's right.
Okay.
Mount Russell, wouldn't have been there.
Mount Russell, a deceptively unimpressive 11,670 feet in height, had, until 1962, principally because of the nature of the steep grade that must be overcome on all climbs, had not remained unclimbed. Principally because of the nature of the steep grade that must be overcome on all climbs.
The winds.
All right.
No place
and
to hide.
That's the next sentence, huh? Okay. Almost vertical, the entire mountain formed an unbroken, inverted cone of jagged granite that was almost continually windswept. Rathel had chosen a worthy adversary on this, his first climb in the last year. Mm-hmm. Okay. After their arrival in Talkeetna in a murky overcast, they had been grounded by continuing foul weather for several days. When the weather broke, Sheldon and Rathel made a quick hop to the mountain, and after studying the peak from the air, mutually agreed upon a possible landing site on the northwest approach. Mount Russell is located near the settlement of Farewell, a place that Sheldon soberly describes as, quote, the home of the winds. That's the name of the chapter. Quote, there is almost always a tremendous air movement in this vicinity, and the high winds from the Gulf of Alaska crash into the area on a collision course with the stuff that's manufactured in the range itself. This is right off the table, quoting directly off the table. The meeting of these two weather masses and unpredictable pressure changes are the main cause of the violent updrafts and swirly winds that I have always found there.
Okay.
Quote, all went well on the weather, and I managed to get Rathel and company located on the mountain, along with a heck of a pile of the usual gear. That's right off the table. Okay. A slight creaking and expansion of the rails and a distant muted blast of air horns announced the arrival of the northbound train from Anchorage. It jogged Sheldon from his brief musings and reminded him that he was about to meet the 10th and last member of the Rathel expedition. Sheldon never met the man, a famous surgeon, but he had no trouble spotting him. Paul, scarred and distinguished, and sporting a moniker, the man called Dr. Von Wetzel by the rest of Rathel's crew alighted from the train amid the hiss of locked air brakes and a thrumming idle of diesel engine. Sheldon was out of the jeep and shaking his hand, and the two were soon stowing both of Von Wetzel's well-worn medical bags in the jeep. With the usual amenities properly put to rest, the surgeon, who had been covertly studying Sheldon, looked into the pilot's bloodshot eyes, sighed deeply, and in a loud voice, gave his professional opinion as to the treatment he deemed necessary for Sheldon's obvious state of exhaustion. Now, I'd already explained that you were tired and beat out before, early in the chapter, when you first got there to the railroad station. Young man, and I cut this right up, what you need is a good night's sleep alone. This completely erroneous diagnosis as to the cause of his fatigue by a world-famous surgeon of Von Wetzel's stature will live in Sheldon's memory for the rest of his days. Okay, so, but now that's a punchline, but that isn't where we end the chapter. Let me go on here. We departed Talkeetna within 30 minutes of Von Wetzel's arrival. This is you talking. Despite his height of 6 1/2 feet, I got the mustachioed surgeon, his two medical bags, and the rest of his gear wedged into the airplane.
I want a demonstration of that wax six
okay,
inch that
put that on the tape. We can
six
add it
inch
in.
Wingspan.
Put her on the tape. We'll add her in. And as I climbed toward 6,000, I tuned in the high frequency radio. Okay. Sheldon and many other bush pilots to the north stand watch on the high frequency band whenever they can, while along, for it is the most likely source of regular and random traffic, including distress calls originating from airplanes and ground-based radio. Okay, Sheldon smoothly leveled the Cessna as the altimeter marked his arrival at the selected cruise altitude and trimmed the plane. Automatically, he matched the directional gyro with the magnetic compass, and over the sounds of the smoothly drumming engine and the slight buzz of static, he heard the unmistakable voice of someone in trouble. And this is a quote. The call was originating at a construction camp about 50 miles north of Talkeetna, and we were headed to the northwest. The
frenzied voice on the radio continued in unabated panic. Von Wetzel scowled slightly as he leaned forward and listened intently. "Please, please, get some help. Caterpillar has just run over one of our men. He's in awful shape. Please hurry." Now here, I don't know the exact words he said, not important. Von Wetzel winced at the abruptness of the almost irrational voice and glanced at Shelton, who was already making the course change that would take them to... What's the name of the creek there, Don? Or the
Troublesome. Troublesome Creek.
Troublesome Creek.
Yeah. Okay. See, that's not...
Cindy, want to give me a ballpoint, please?
That's about 25 miles.
Oh, okay. Well, this is the stuff you can put in there.
Yeah, you see, but first I asked you if you would care to go and give you some first aid for this victim.
Yeah, well, let me finish.
And he said, yeah, I fix him up.
Right here. Hold on. That's the next sentence. Let me just put down Troublesome Creek here. So that's pretty good. Troublesome Creek. That was troublesome already. Okay. Von Wetzel winced at the abruptness and the almost irrational voice and glanced at Shelton, who was already making the course change that would take them to Troublesome Creek, the scene of the accident. Shelton asked Von Wetzel if he thought that he could help the man. The surgeon's reply was a grunted,
"Yeah." He said, "Yeah, I fixed him.
You take me there, but quickly." Oh. Now, that's what you said to me the other day. In minutes.
"Yeah, I fix him up," is what he said.
Okay, we can add that.
Yeah.
In minutes, the camp was passing beneath the nose of the Cessna. Shelton banked steeply, tipping the silver airplane on its right wing tip as he rapidly searched for a possible place to land. Luckily, the air was smooth and flat, and during those first few minutes of searching, this looked like the only blessing that the day was to hold. Then, suddenly, Shelton noticed that there was a stretch of relatively smooth sand along a narrow, brush-studded bar of the creek that meandered near the construction camp. And without his usual cautious second look, pulled on full flaps, chopped the throttle, and tipped the nose earthward. It is said by most airmen that the best landings are the logical result of careful planning. The time allowed for deliberation on this one was severely curtailed by circumstances, but the landing was perfect. And the wheels beneath their retractable skis rolled to a stop in the first half inch of creek water at the far end of the river bank. Quote, "We came to a stop just opposite the site of the accident and about 300 yards away," unquote. Von Wetzel, his medical bag clutched in one hand and his monocle flashing in the sun, unhesitatingly waded the cold, fast-flowing creek. He was closely followed by Shelton, and in minutes they were crouched beside the accident victim, who had indeed been run over by a Caterpillar tractor, a huge D9 model. Quote, "By the time we got there was possibly a dozen members of the construction camp, all crowding around their injured compatriot. I noticed a cook, complete with a white cap and apron, rushing around trying to make the victim comfortable. Or trying to make the victim, who was in excruciating pain, as comfortable as possible. He had been crushed from his toes to his waist and was still conscious. Von Wetzel went to work immediately and soon had him splinted fore and aft. As I looked at the job he had done in so short a time, it suddenly dawned on me that I'd never get the guy into the 180 because you couldn't bend him with all of those splints, but I had an idea." Shelton hurried back to the Cessna, reached in to tune the panel radio and grabbed the mic. He hit the jackpot, and after but a few tries on the high-frequency radio, he was talking with a pilot of a helicopter that, by extreme good fortune, was cruising in the immediate area. The chopper was soon stirring the dry sand on the river bar as it landed, and in minutes, Sheldon and the others had the moaning construction worker loaded and lashed to the side rack of the machine, which left in a chuffing roar for the Providence Hospital in Anchorage.
No, they left for Tough King.
Okay, well,
yeah, yeah, but well, here's what really happened. He took him to Talkeen. See, these choppers are on charter, and we radioed ahead, and as the chopper landed, he's met by a CAP Beaver.
Okay.
I'd like to get the CAP in there.
Yeah, okay.
Because they...
Let me make a note of that. Left in a chuffing roar for Talkeen.
Right.
Okay. Four.
And upon their arrival,
Talkeetna. I'll just put a note here.
Upon their arrival.
Okay, but I'll write it in later. I don't want to write it now. It's hard to do here.
Loaded the victim into the waiting doors of a Beaver aircraft, and were
Anchorage and Beaver
on their way. he was on the operating table 4 hours after the accident.
It should be explained here that Sheldon is often called upon to rush to the scene of many non-mountain climbing accidents, and still is. Many are the foggy nights that via HF radio he is contacted by the state police. Is that a true statement?
Yeah.
Okay. To rush to a landing on a cordon segment of wet road, oh, often with only the aid of flares or headlights of patrol cars. He is no stranger to the mutilation that follows a head-on collision, and has by necessity become a proficient and knowledgeable medic in his own right. He has learned the symptoms of injuries that make transport even in his airplanes unadvisable. Though his airborne ambulance service has accounted for many quick trips to Anchorage and not a few saved lives.
Okay.
Now, Keaton is located many miles from the nearest clinic. There are no doctors in town. At one time, the pilot even kept a car parked at Merrill Field, Anchorage's oldest major airstrip, which happens to be closer to the hospital than the main airport. The car's purpose was singular, occasionally providing the fastest service to the hospital available. The system worked well until someone stole the car and ripped the engine from beneath the hood, at which time Sheldon opted not to replace it. Quote, 7 months later, on another hospital run to the Anchorage area, I had delivered my passengers and was walking down the main corridor of the hospital as I left. I was surprised to see someone who looked very familiar. It was Orville Engelhorn, the man who had been run over by the D-9, and he was walking down the hall with the aid of crutches. After we talked a while, I said, Orville, tell me, what was the worst part of that whole episode? Now, what I'll do here, I'll put at Troublesome Creek. Okay, Engelhorn rested on his crutches and looked past Sheldon as he remembered. This is him talking. I guess you probably think it was the pain he grinned, and I guess I'll never forget that. What with my bones crushed clean to my hips. Now, here again, this is reconstructed dialogue. But the worst part was what that damn cook did to me. I don't know where he said damn, but I put it in there. You can scratch it out if you want. They no more than got the cat off me when he come to running with a fifth of scotch, which he forced me to drink, and there ain't nothing that I hate worse than scotch. And that's the end of that incident. Okay, after the side trip to 8 Engelhorn, Sheldon and the surgeon had continued to Mount Russell, where Von Wetzel joined forces with Rathel and the rest of the crew. Sheldon encountered building turbulence and heavily gusting winds as on the landing. Barely got airborne and opted to go to the settlement at Lake Minchuma rather than buck the wind back to Talkeetna. He waited for 8 hours there and finally returned home. Okay. On May 28, 1962, Hans Eckerlein, Robert Goodwin, Peter Henning, all members of Rathel's expedition stood at the summit of the 11,670-foot peak. They stood in the blowing snow, where no man had ever stood before, and another of the as yet unclimbed neighbors of the towering McKinley had been conquered. Sheldon, more than any man alive, has had intimate contact with the climbing of peaks in the majestic McKinley group. Now, if you stop and think about that for a minute, that's a pretty all-inclusive statement, but it's true. Even you take a single climber, a guy that's gone up the route on foot and back, he hasn't had as much contact with that mountain, never will have as much as you have. Because you know all the climbing groups. Let me just finish. There's only a couple of pages here. He has taken part in many of the first climbs, has shared the heartbreak of those that did not succeed, and seldom is he surprised to hear of new innovations that climbers make in their efforts to reach the high peaks. Hans Metz, a Swiss mountaineer, had made his own innovation, but they related to the trip down Mount McKinley rather than its ascent. He would ski. Sheldon liked the irrepressible Metz. Now, I don't know whether he was irrepressible or not, but I'm just guessing.
Good guess.
Okay. And was impressed with the fact that he planned to journey cross-country to the mountain, climb it with the aid of skis, and then return via the same route. He agreed to transport the expedition's gear and deposit all 7,000 pounds of it at the 7,000-foot level in the
field. 1,000 pounds.
Oh, okay.
There's only five members.
That's what I thought. That's why I hesitated when I read that. All right, you had 7 on the other tape. You must have misspoken something. I played it about 5 times. Okay, so it's 1,000 pounds. That's all. I thought to myself, you 7,000 pounds of gear. God. Okay, 1,000 pounds of gear at the 7,000 foot level on the Cahokia Glacier. One of the expedition members, due to other commitments, had to be flown into the drop area, where he would join up with the rest of the party for the climb to the south summit. Metz and his crew were successful and scaled the mountain with the aid of skis. Due to climbing conditions and other considerations, it was impossible for Metz to launch his ski descent from the summit, though he and his companions did ski much of the long way down. They passed the 7,000-foot landing site on the way out and eventually returned to the bank of the Susitna River opposite the village of Talkeetna, where they were met by a riverboat. On the way out, they had encountered the same difficulties that plagued the Heinrich Harrer expedition on the outbound course from Mount Hunter: bad weather and bears. On May 17, 1962, just 11 days prior to the Rathel expedition's first ascent of Mount Russell, Metz was credited with the 24th successful ascent of McKinley Summit. Yeah, before we get on that, how that sound to you?
Good.
Yeah.
Looky.
I think you'll like it.
Yeah. Listen, we didn't talk about Sedan, the great French skier. All right. Now, Sedan is one of the great skiers in the world. Now, he skis in his own particular element. He skied down the route that the Machico Sequeira expedition fell.
Hmm.
This gives you an idea of what type of a skier he is.
Do you know by any chance how that guy spells his name now?
S-U-D-A-N.
What?
I think it's more Sal Sudan.
Ah, okay.
All right. Sudan, I can give his pedigree and everything from Janae because he knows him well. Anyway, he appeared with a photographic crew, and the trouble was skiing down from the peak of McKinley to the bottom is the difficulties near the top, the rock. What Sedan did was start from 19,300. Hilton Horn, and he skied down to the 14,300 foot level, and here's how he did it. He came down an avalanche chute, not in the thunderous roar to exceed the speed of sound, but in a series of thousands of jump turns, each one a do or die maneuver. 180 degree turn jump, watch that avalanche, you just kick loose an avalanche above you, jump, miss it, left and right. He made 3,000 precision jump turns in 1 mile of almost straight down, steep enough to use a parachute on. And
he'd be lucky he didn't have to stop for a breathing.
Unfortunately, I don't think that he started from the exact summit of McKinley. His press wrote it up as having started from the summit of McKinley. And immediately, the poo-poo-ers and the people in the area tore it down as having said, oh, he is as far as he did not ski from the summit. From 19-3, this we know because I see the tracks. We photographed his tracks as he made his 3,000 precision jump turns.
The important thing is he didn't have to come down from the top to make a real trip. It was the way he made it that counts, right?
Yeah, but the thing is,
when did this happen, Don? When was Sudan up there? What year? What month?
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Yeah,
71. In other words, this would have been after. The two Japs, excuse
you. It must have been 72.
They were in 70?
72.
Japs were in 70.
No, Machico Sequeira?
No, no. the skiers, the two Jap skiers.
Oh, yeah, 71. Yeah, but there was
a period
of time.
Was up there after those two Jap skiers?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But I don't believe that they had the technical know-how to come down this from 19-3 straight down. He skied it all the way.
Well, I don't know how they came
in
down.
In a few minutes, Janae was up there with another expedition.
Yeah.
And he implored him to please go to the top and talk to him in six foreign languages to try to psych him into please go to the top
so
of
that he
McKinley.
Could do it all the way down.
But Sinan, he said, spent 2 hours adjusting his ski bindings.
Why didn't he want to go all the way to the top?
Because the altitude. He was afraid. A man who with known capabilities.
Uh-huh.
And it was tremendously cold that day with a sharp wind.
Mm-hmm.
And the time was now or never.
He was splitting hairs at that point.
The time was now or never.
Right.
And Sudan elected to use his wits to, and that last lateral 4,000 feet vertical, 1,000 feet, would have took the edge off him.
Right.
See?
Right.
And so Sudan elected to take off from the 19,300 footer.
Right.
And as a result, the French press advertised that he skied from the top of McKinley even before he skied.
Yeah, right.
And Janae was there, and it disgusted Janae.
Yeah.
Because here you have a great athlete
cut
off at the ankle.
Yeah.
Because of what the press said.
Yeah. Or you could look at it another way. The guy obviously didn't care about the starting right from the top. He just wanted to ski the toughest part of it, you know.
Huh.
He knew that he couldn't hack that.
Well,
from a coordination standpoint.
In his mind, a tremendous athlete and a small man. Don't about like Janae.
Huh.
But
you know,
with tremendous length.
That's true in many, many sports. Especially mountain climbing and skiing. And mountain climbing, as you well know, you know, they're small men.
Yeah.
Look at the Sherpas.
Yeah.
You know, those dudes are
all
little men.
Crew.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's what you take. Big lungs, small body. You know?
Yeah.
And lots of wiry strength.
Yeah.
So,
anyway, I have to mention Sudan.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Because, and I want you to...
I can put that in there.
I want you to put that on there.
No problem.
Because
do you remember the exact month? And did you say 72 he went up there or 71 now? 72. Do you remember the month? I like to pin it down to a month. Okay.
Well, I'll check that with you today.
Yeah. Okay. Now I'm going to be calling down there Thursday night now at 7-8 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
And anything like this that you think of, you know.
Yeah.
Just write it down, and when I call you...
With him, he had 10 or 12 members. He even brought a gorgeous starlet from the French Riviera with him. And she developed pneumonia at altitude, and I airlifted her out of 14-3, which is not unexpected. But that we won't put in the tape. That's for your information.
Okay. Here's... No, it's not... Yeah, here's what's left. I had to rewrite to make it fit the book. I had to rewrite the Dave Aiding climb. Not rewrite the whole thing. But remember all that, what I now call crap that I had in there, the first start? Mushy stuff, that's all out.
Good.
She's all out of there now. And she goes right into the climb. And anyway, you're going to have what I'm going to say is, Don, you're going to have a hard time reading this.
Oh, no.
Yeah, look at what it is here. Jesus,
you're not having a hard time.
Barfed up. You guys are going to find a little tough time, I'm afraid.
No. Listen.
Just take it along, take it slow. It's all there, you know.
Dr. Wilson.
Follow my arrows and stuff. You'll be able to read.
On the Dave Aiding deal was on the scene, and he... has some good pictures, and I'm going to tap him off.
Okay.
And listen.
Just a week.
Between when Yuiki went up there and when...
Yeah, well, how about Uemura, the great solo climber? You didn't even hear about him.
No, I didn't put it in here.
Well, you've got to have it.
Jesus, Don, we haven't got enough room.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to have to go on the next book.
No.
Yes, it is.
No.
I've got, yes.
Look, this is.
Listen, I've got write-ups in here, and there ain't no spare words outside of what's necessary to make a book.
In two or three paragraphs, you could get Huey Moore, a man, only man.
Did you fly him up there?
Sure did.
All right, put her down. I'm not going to promise I can get in there.
All right.
But look at, this is why Kine was saying, let's write another book. Because,
yeah.
Dad, we've got, we can do this stuff, see?
Well, let's put the mountain stuff in the mountain book.
Well,
and
okay,
the Huey Moore is the mountain.
Yeah, okay, but there's a lot
put
more.
Put the hunting expeditions
in
the different
but
book.
There's going to be mountain stuff in the other one, too. There's got to be, because you've done too much of it, you know. I mean, there's just no end of the stuff that you've done in relation to mountains.
Yeah, but you don't want to put Huey Moore a solo in the mountain in a hunting picture.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The other one will be a combination.
Listen, and I want to put Michiko Sakita as a solo McKinley climber, too.
I'll be in there, don't worry. That's the whole last
chapter. For her lost expedition,
right,
she climbed McKinley's solo.
I know it. That's the whole last chapter, and I got that last night on tape.
Well,
so
I tell you.
That's going to be the whole last chapter of the book.
You know, I heard, and she told us, she would personally, she's a teacher in Japan. She teaches the deaf and the blind. And her wage is $200 a month.
Was she doing that when she climbed up?
Yeah.
But that was her job when she came up here.
Listen to this. And the parents of the lost expedition members wouldn't let her come back to Japan unless she brought her members with her. And I just thought of the name of the husband that I took up, Watanabe, who came along in disbelief to collect his wife. And you remember I landed Watanabe,
yeah,
Michiko,
yeah,
Sakita, Janae, and Titus all in one blast with all their gear.
Was he a mountain climber, Don?
Obviously. No. Well, they all are to a point.
Well, I know, but I mean, was this
he,
is a, this
he
is
was
an interesting point. Was he a mountain climber like his wife? Or was he just...
He had been exposed to a small amount of mountain
climbing. Okay, because that's interesting.
But
you know, here the guy is her husband, and he says, I'll get up there somehow, you know.
Actually,
type.
He was not...
Okay.
A mountaineer.
Okay.
He was awed by the mountain, and he was afraid of the mountain.
Great.
But
that's
he
good,
still went up there after.
Right. Well, that's a good thing to put in the book.
Yeah.
Okay, that's why I asked you about it.
And then you have them.
Janae, Titus, Watanabe, and you were up there.
Yeah.
Right? And Michiko Sakita.
Yeah. And all their stuff, land them at 10-2. I came up the pass.
Did you take them into the 180?
Yeah, the turbo job.
Okay.
I made it non-shot in 42 minutes direct. That's when I found out what the turbo system was good for.
Yeah. Okay.
42 minutes from talking. Five of us, 350 pounds of gear non-stop. Pow! 42 minutes.
Wow.
And take off 300 feet.
Okay, what about this... You wanted to tell me now about Michiko Sakita teaching the blind.
Yeah,
not making much money. Okay.
She's making $200 a month.
And she's American?
No, they teach in Japanese blind.
No, I know, but I mean $200, is that American?
Yeah, a value of yen.
Okay,
so she tells me, you know, they're very kindred people,
mm-hmm,
and touching people. And polite and considerate and deeply affected and more than deeply affected by this horrible ordeal. Furthermore, from our house she called Japan, and each call was even worse than the last. It would wind up in the tone of the exchange was unmistakable, see? And she told us that she was unable to allow to return to Japan ever without her members. If she did return, she would have to pay personally for the helicopter charter. She'd have to pay the Japanese consul every cent that they spent in expense-wise for helicopter flying, which was a commercial helicopter to the tune of about $3,000.
Who'd they charter the helicopter?
One of the anchorage operators.
Uh-huh.
It takes a special helicopter. It takes an Alouette II.
Turbo.
Oh, well, not any turbo.
No.
Do it. An Alouette will do it. But okay. Anyway, it costs $2,000 of special helicopter. I looked for a week, but I was looking in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
I concentrated. I looked in the right place, but the avalanche covered them up from above. A helicopter flying almost eye level 50 feet away with Janae's sharp eye spotted.
I wonder if his rotor blast had any wheel.
No, it's an avalanche in the fall.
Oh, no. I mean, maybe when he hovered, maybe the rotor blast picked some snow off them.
Maybe so.
Okay.
Maybe it's a possibility.
Right.
But the swirling, it very well may have been.
Which could have caused.
I thought of that.
Okay.
So.
All right, so she was going to lose face if she went back. Plus
face,
okay,
she wasn't
going
to be allowed to go back to Japan.
Okay, but it's going to be tough to write that and explain it. That's why I wanted to ask you about it.
Well, I'll tell you how it is, and you can do what you
want.
Yeah,
I know it, but it's going to be tough. In other words, if I just put down now, you know, she was not going to be allowed to come back to Japan unless she paid, you know.
No, not unless she wasn't going to be allowed, period.
Okay. Well, you just got done saying that if she didn't recover the rest of her climbing crew.
Now, if she did find them, she could come back. And she's going to have to pay every cent expenses for everybody.
Regardless.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
How will she go back and teach
if
she's not allowed to return to the country?
Well, no, right.
Boy, the press is on to find those people.
In other words, no way, regardless of whether they find them or not,
and she
is the Japanese government going to pay for the helicopter.
No way.
Okay.
Nor a telephone call nor a wire.
Okay.
And the parents were. You see, in Japan, it's different.
Yeah.
It's a military operation. If you take a hunter out, you're in command of the hunter, I suppose. Or if you lead a climbing expedition, you're in command. They do what you say or else.
And you're responsible.
Right. And if something happens to them, it's you.
Yeah. Okay.
Her crew suffered. The fall, it's her fault.
Yeah.
She should have commanded them to hold at 16,000 or to take everybody down to the 9. And
that's a good part of the story.
Yeah.
It's a really, this
all right. And we tried to, I told Roberta, let's see if we can, I got her off the mountain as soon as I could for a break. See?
Right.
To try to, give her a change of pace.
Yeah.
Boy, her nerves were shot.
Oh,
actually. And then when she talked to her, the various nearest kin and all, we scrambled her. I mean, scrambled her.
Yes.
And so then when I took them back to the mountain, part of it was resolved. But there remained this insurmountable $3,000 helicopter bill.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to Roberta, hey, let's not charge this whole doggone operation for their flights. We've got to make the gas. We'll charge them one way and nothing for bringing any of them out. For all the high altitude flying, the 5 days of searching in our busy time. And so we put a nominal charge on the inbound flight and a complimentary no charge on all of the rest of the whole operation that took place over 10 days.
Boy, that'll be that.
Yeah, boy.
That'll make it last.
I don't want to advertise that.
I know,
I'm telling you what we did.
It's going to go in there. I want it to. It's got to go in there, Doc.
Yeah.
Because
you see,
for more than one reason, that's but
yeah.
What all I'm saying is that this whole thing is a beautiful way to end this particular book, because it starts with the Machiko Sakita thing and ends with it, you know? And the whole Machiko Sakita expedition is a pile of the exact things that the whole book's about, you know?
Yeah.
The whole thing. So, great. Good. I tell you, Don, we got her, I think. The only thing I might have to do, like I said before, is give you the odd call in the next week, and when I'm actually writing these last couple three chapters, we'll have it. What about this guy you said had to be in there now? This that's
Marcel Soudan.
Marcel Soudan. In other words,
you've
already described the way he got down the mountain.
Oh,
And it'll be in
fabulous Frenchman. I say he's a great joker too.
He's still around, I assume.
Oh yeah. I say Sedan, he's a great joker. And he speaks excellent Harvard English. And I say, Sedan, suppose you slip. Yeah. I says, we went over and reconnaissance the route for several hours. Ooh, very close to
him. Yeah.
From high altitude. From the top to the bottom. I say, Sedan, what if you slip? He say, he says, if I slip, she's au revoir.
Au revoir. Jesus, I guess it would be. Jesus,
I say, Sedan, not au revoir. I furnish you parachute. He say, ha, ha, ha.
Yeah. No parachute on that one, boy.
Jeez.
God, can you imagine a guy starting to ski down that son of a...
Oh. What a rock.
You know,
what he did is ski down the next avalanche, our sweep of the hourglass, the avalanche chute next to where the Mosquito Sequoia, the Chico Sequoia, who fell. They fell in a comparable place where he skied. It's almost straight down. He skied it by skiing crosswise. Ski, jump.
He's making 180 degree jump turns at the end of each of these things, so he can stand.
Slow.
But the thing is,
the avalanche. He had to jump out of the way. He turned the avalanche loose. Ski, avalanche, whoop, jump, ski, jump, whoop, over the avalanche.
Every time
he's jumping the avalanches, the avalanche is crashing underneath him.
You should have got a movie
of the crew. Oh, well,
he
did.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Who took the film?
His TV crew. God, he had a 10-12 man crew.
Were they,
and they
lowered
themselves. They climbed up to the horn of Cahilton Horn and lowered their cameras 3,000 feet down the avalanche, shooting, watching go by with fisheye lenses coming down from above.
Jeez.
And going down from... No, I didn't, but I'm telling you, I saw the tracks. Oh, well, in Switzerland, and the Swiss and Italian Alps, he does the same thing. But here you've got skis.
Yeah, I can just visualize that. Like.
On an angle you can't believe, and he's making jump turns.
Over avalanche.
Yeah, over the avalanche whistling under him.
Yeah.
He's cut loose.
How far down did he go?
Well, he went to 5,000 feet.
How long did it take?
4 hours. Tremendous. You've got to put the Sedan.
Okay, it'll be in there.
Oh. Nobody
I'm
will.
I'm telling you, Don, this thing, it'll be in there. I guarantee you, I'll put that in there. But man, this thing's running like 62,000 words already. Just, and believe me, it's not, everything's paired out as right now, the extra wording is concerned. And, you know, they're going to go, what I'm afraid I'm going to run into right now between, I figure I've got another, 5,000-6,000 words, see, I can devote to the last two chapters.
Listen, what
there's
we
plenty.
Forgot. But
the thing is, We don't want to get ourselves to a point where we've got so much material in the book that Rand McNally arbitrarily says, look, take this out. They'll
no,
do
no,
it.
No, they're not going to do it.
You don't think so?
They're going to take the only solo climber of McKinley in history out of the
book. Who knows, Don? This is the thing that I don't want to run the risk of. Don't know.
Let them worry about it.
No, let you and me worry about it.
It won't be that much. I think it's
important. All right, but I'm talking about the total content of the book.
Oh, well.
They may end up leaving that in and take the Wilcox expedition out.
Oh, no.
Don't think they won't. I'm telling you, Don, I don't want
to... We'll tear up the birth certificate.
Yeah. I don't want to get into a position where all of a sudden they look at it and say, oh, my God, you've got 70,000 words here. We're only going to need about 55, which is all we can publish in the book.
Looky.
Well, you say no. I'm telling you it can happen. Yeah, but now, I know it can happen.
Cross the bridge before you get to it.
I'm not going to sit down and write 85 or 80,000 words knowing that they're going to chop it down to 55. It's stupid.
But in three paragraphs, you could do the...
I'm not talking about the Sudan thing. I'm talking about the book in general.
Oh, yeah.
If well, we hand them...
Book, give them a chance.
John, look at, listen to what I'm telling you. If we hand them 70,000 words and they want 55 and they can't budget any more than the publication of 55,000 words, they're going to say, okay, now, look, this is all great, but you've got way too much text. We're going to have to telescope it. That's their famous word. Telescoping means chopping it out and watering it down. And I don't want to end up doing that.
Put more muscle in it.
Well, you're not taking it seriously.
I know.
You're not taking it seriously, and you've got to, Don.
Well,
because I'm the guy that's putting every night until 1, 2 in the morning right in this phone ticker, and I'm telling you, I don't want to voluntarily, knowingly sit down and write 20,000 words that they're not going to use. Because they own it. We write 20,000 words, and they got it. They own it.
What else would you do with it?
Put it in another book.
One item of the soul.
There's dozens of items, Don. The next, if we write another book, it's not going to be just hunting. It's going to be a combination of everything.
Items, we'll take them back and put them in another book.
Well, all right, we can do this.
See? Yeah, let's
but the
do
thing
that.
Is, we're going to get into a big hassle with them.
We don't
know what they're going to want to knock out because they don't have any feeling for what's going on up here. They know what's good. But they don't know what's going on up here. They may come along and just say, look, that little episode with Sudan is great, but Sheldon didn't have very much to do with it, really, so let's chop it. Now, what are you going to say when they do that?
We'll put that in a different section.
If you're willing to do that at the time they edit it,
don't
fine.
Sweat.
No problem.
Don't sweat.
Okay.
But at least you'll have a record.
Right. But the thing is, no, you can see what I'm talking about now.
Oh.
They said early on, we want 55,000. They got a budget. They're crazy.
Some guys worry because they can't get the
right
hard number.
But the thing is, see, they got a budget that they're gonna that they've already set up that they can put into this book. That was the basis of the contract.
Oh yeah.
See?
Yeah.
Okay. So they want to stick pretty close to that.
Hey.
So the farther I go beyond that, right now, if nothing else, it means time.
Yeah.
Hey. See?
Do you know how many words the book of Seagull has?
John Winter Seagull, probably, I just guess, and I'd probably say,
there's not much.
I'd say probably 20,000, the most.
Maybe.
15,000.
You know how many pages you just got?
You know how long it took you to write, Jonathan Winter Seagull? 18 days, total time.
Yeah.
From the idea to the manuscript.
Yeah, but listen, you know what Reader's Digest did to it?
No, I don't know. Probably the same thing they've done to everything they've published.
Yeah.
Watered it down to the point where nobody
really
can get
it. No, they don't water it. They hope to get the muscle out of it.
They water it down in the process. I've never heard anything yet that was in Reader's Digest that wasn't a skeleton of what actually happened.
Yeah.
They got to do it that way. They get it in the book.
Well, these facts.
That's the one thing that we want to watch, too, that Rand McNally is going to watch. What happens a lot of times, you've seen these book-length features, in a magazine like Argus. There's a 695 book-length feature of a coming book. Boy, that's bad. Usually what happens, it's not a coming book, it's a book that's already been published and failed.
Okay?
So you never want to let the publishing company release that before the book is out. Because, people read that thing in the magazine.
How
well,
if you
why
read
buy
a
the book?
Condensed version, why read the book?
And the same goes true with paperback. This is why nobody wants to have a book published in paperback, the first edition.
Hey, 48 was the paperback to start with.
Right. But that was just through the fact that he sold it for as a paperback. But they
How much
do you
suppose they made on that?
Hey,
I'll tell you one thing. There's thousands and thousands of climbers, and they all come to Talkeetna with a 148.
Yeah.
And a mountain of my fear in the other pocket.
Wait till we get this one done, boy.
Well, what are we going to name it?
I don't know. They're going to title it. They'll title it. Look, don't worry about the title, because I'm with you 100% on the title. You and I both want the kind of a title. We want the same kind of a title.
What do you think?
I don't know. I thought Home of the Winds would be a good title for it. How does that hit you?
Well, that's better.
Sure. What I don't want on it, I don't want farthest north bush pilot, you know, right? I'm just, that's an example, I'm exaggerating. But that's the kind of thing that he's thinking of right now. Yeah. And I'm looking, you said don't anticipate trouble. I'm looking right now to an extended period of correspondence over that title. Because I'm not about to agree for those guys putting a title like farthest north bush pilot. No way. So I've thought of a thousand titles, but none of them are worth a damn. I don't think. Fragile Falcon. That was another one I thought was good. A Fragile Falcon. That sounds pretty nice. Home of the Winds. That's a good one, though.
That's better.
I think I'm going to suggest that one. See, I'm going to make a list. I told him on the phone last time. I said, look. Oh, yeah. Sutton. I talked to him.
What kind of a guy is he?
Oh, he seems like a nice guy.
Yeah.
He's a young guy. He sounds like a real nice guy.
Young
and
guy?
I said, hey, yeah. Well, one of the things last time when I called him, he said, hey, are you paying for this call? I said, yeah, I'm Chicago. He said, look, from now on, call me Clay.
Ah, don't forget.
You know, so anyway, but he's a nice guy. So anyway, I'm talking to him, and I said, hey, I had a whole list of questions I had asked him. I said, how about chapter titles? I said, do you want me to suggest chapter titles? Yeah, he says, go ahead and put chapter titles down. And he says, we'll stick to all of your suggestions pretty much on the chapter titles, you know, that's not that important to the chapter title. I says, okay, how about the book title? Well, he says, we usually assign the title. I said, yeah, I know that. That's in the contract. But I said, what about, can I give you some suggestions? Oh, yeah. He says, you bet. Give us some suggestions. And I said, well, I said, we'd like to get some kind of a title on it that's not corny, you know. I think that's what I said. Well, yeah, he says, but I said, what do you have in mind? I asked him. Well, he says, oh, I don't know. We hadn't really. They've got guys they assigned to that. They're good at titling books. He says we have to wait till we read the manuscript, which is obvious. And he says we had in mind maybe something with bush pilot. That's what he says. And I said okay, but I said look, don't please title it something. I said I'm not about to let you title. I think that's what I said. Let you title it something as corny as like the farthest north bush pilot.
Ah.
He says. Yeah, he says, but by the same token, he says, we don't want to have something like Death Rides in the Cabin with Sheldon. I said, okay, I agree. But I said, maybe about a third of the way in between there someplace, we're going to come to a title that doesn't sound like Helmert's book.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Christ, the last of the bush pilots.
Oh,
Christ. You know, I want to get something a little more sophisticated than that.
Yeah.
So I'm with you on the title, 100%.
Yeah.
And we'll get a good title.
Well, that's so we were talking about this. Bush pilot is
what?
Alaska means, everybody knows what it means, but down below they don't.
That's it. Bush pilot down below, Don, is still a pretty romantic word.
It is?
You know, oh, yeah.
Oh,
but, yeah,
it is.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, all right.
People know what it is, and the minute they hear the word bush pilot, they think, geez, you know, the far north, this type of thing. Really, this is true.
Mm.
To us, bush pilot is just a 2-cent word. You know, I mean, it's like a plumber. You know. Okay, but I'm just saying. So, you know, it isn't quite as corny to as it sounds, although it's still corny. I agree with that. So anyway, we aren't kind of about to let them title that cat picture. What did you say, Cindy, about the title?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Sheldon, you ever seen a movie where the book is called Rainy Day?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I heard about
Alistair McQueen.
That about?